I'm Rose Scott.
And I'm Dennis O'Hare. Good to have you with us. Research suggests there are disparities by race when it comes to diagnosing and treating people with autism. The Marcus Autism Center here in Atlanta serves more than 5,000 children with autism and related disorders each year. And with a look at all that and where some of those disparities might lie, Céline Saunier, Director of Clinical Research Operations, and Chris Gunter, Associate Director of Research at Marcus. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you.
Thank you for having us.
When we look at this, and Céline Saunier, I'll start with you. Who's predominantly diagnosed with autism? When we talk about disparities by race, is it because there are differences in the diagnosis right up front?
That's a great question. So first, let's start with the general prevalence of autism is 1 in 68, so a little more than 1% of the population. We do ascertain more white children than we do, for example, blacks and Hispanics, but we are doing a better job of diagnosing blacks and Hispanics. So what we need to do is ascertain more people of disadvantaged and minority populations.
And when you see that, is that because it's just an education thing? Because communities which have fewer resources don't have the education about what the signs of autism might be, so they don't bring the kids in? Or is there something going on here with genetics, perhaps, that's linked to ethnicity?
I'll speak to the ethnographic stuff first, and then I'll pass it over to my colleague Chris about the genetics. When we're talking about resources, you hit the nail on the head. Research shows that it really is more about socioeconomic status than it is about race or ethnicity. So families from more disadvantaged communities, whether it's rural or very urban, they're going to have less access to care and less empowerment to advocate for care. So either they're going to have children that are misdiagnosed or not diagnosed at all.
And we also see cultural differences in terms of who seeks out care, which is part of what you're getting at. And, you know, the term autism is becoming such a catch-all that it has so many things in it that it's really hard to disentangle this. But in terms of genetics, as a human geneticist, that's my training, we don't use the word race as much. We use ancestry and ethnic origin, that type of thing. We have so far found at least 100 genes which are linked to autism in some way. Are any of those different in different ethnic origins? Almost certainly. Absolutely. Have we been able to disentangle that yet? No, we haven't.
You mentioned less empowerment and also access, and that brings me to thinking about prenatal care and when parents talk to their pediatricians, what's the role of doctors and community health centers and also being able to get information to the social disadvantaged communities then?
Sure. Well, doctors play a very critical role, primary care physicians and pediatricians. And what ends up happening is, depending on the culture, there could be a stigma associated with having a disability, or it could be the physician saying, let's take a wait-and-see approach, and downplaying the concerns that a family's raising. It could be either of those things or both that lead to it. But what research does show is that then there ends up being a mistrust between families from disadvantaged communities and their primary care physicians. So they're less likely to actually talk to them about their concerns. So we as a community have to be better at this in our cultural awareness.
And so from awareness to diagnosis, now let's look at resources and treatments for afterwards. Then we're seeing a disparity here. We're seeing a real disparity. Is it because of health insurance? Is it just because of lack of resources, financial resources, for the family?
I think the resources are really critical, because we're very fortunate to be in Atlanta, where we have a center like Marcus. There's the Emory Autism Center. There's the CDC. There are so many different places that one can go to in Atlanta. Then you get to rural Georgia, and there's very little access to care. So we're trying to make efforts with telemedicine, for example, to reach out to those communities that don't have immediate access. But around the country and around the world, that doesn't exist. So absolutely, access to care is a critical component. I think the more we talk about it, the more awareness that there is, the better. But we still have a long way to go.
And the Marcus Autism Center is actually the biggest provider of telemedicine for the Children's Healthcare of Atlanta system. So that's something that we're definitely trying to make happen more often.
Well, tell us about that. Tell us how that, I mean, we know what telemedicine is, but how is it working? How is it beneficial?
Yeah, it seems to work well. So in that case, what we do is actually enlist the parents and caregivers to take some video and show us some of that video. So that helps us with the diagnosis, for example. So we don't have to actually necessarily be there with a kid for all. We can reach more kids that way. So that's part of it. And then also, you know, doing something like Skype and being able to see the children and being able to talk to them and interact with them, that's very important for us.
But for all of the improvements in access, and for as far as we still have to go, there's still the question that Rose brought up of resources. Are we seeing, and Ms. Sonia, I'll start with you, are we seeing some parents who might think there's something going on, but think, okay, if I get a diagnosis of something along the autism spectrum, it's going to be enormously expensive to treat. I may have to have the child go to, say, a school for a while or something like that. I won't be able to get the child there, so they don't even start the process.
Sure. And here in the state of Georgia, just this past January, Ava's Law was passed. So we now have insurance coverage for children under the age of 6 years.
Right.
So it's a baby step. We still have a long way to go, but it's something for those children. But absolutely, for children over the age of six, they're going to be fighting for services, whether within their school district or private services.
And do the treatments differ as we go along between, say, a younger child and a child who's a little older?
Absolutely. We think of autism as more of a trajectory, a
right.
neurodevelopmental trajectory. So can we help change that trajectory so that they pick up more skills, so that they pick up more language, et cetera? Absolutely. The treatments definitely change. And so that's why we'd love to see children earlier and earlier so that we can get in earlier, help them learn language earlier, which is one of the best predictors of how they'll be able to function in normal societal activities, et cetera. That's one of the most important things that we try to do.
We're speaking with Celine Sonnier, Director of Clinical Research Operations, and Chris Gunter, the Associate Director of Research at the Marcus Autism Center. We're talking about racial disparity in diagnosis and treatment of people, but particularly we're talking about kids with autism. The question that I think that many people out there listening might have is, particularly when we're talking about the minority community, how important is it also to make sure that in those community centers, in those areas where you have children of color, that also there are people working in this field who are of color, because that has always been an issue in terms of cultural competency and everything else as it relates to health care for minorities.
Absolutely. And we make an effort to have to be hiring people on our staff that do diagnostic evaluations and treatment that not only are culturally diverse but speak different languages. Because for when we're doing an assessment, if English is not the primary language, we can get a translator, but we really need to better understand the culture of that family and their community.
Are you having issues with that, challenges with that?
Yeah, one of our colleagues, Samuel Fernandez-Cariba, actually, that's what he studies. So he's one of the cutting edge people in the world, I guess, working on cultural competence and how that affects the diagnosis and treatment, et cetera. So that is very important to us.
But if language is a barrier, Ms. Gunter, just to pursue that, if language is a barrier for the parents, then when you're communicating with a child who might have difficulty speaking because of whatever it is that he or she has, does that make it even harder to treat that child? And that might be another reason why we're seeing the disparities.
Absolutely. I'll let Celine answer that. We use many, many translators, which we bring in for diagnosis and treatment in all different languages. But
yeah, I should highlight here that autism is a social communication disorder,
right,
not just a speech disorder. So
yeah,
someone who has an absence of speech, a child with autism on top of that will present very differently. So even the nonverbal communication is going to be impaired. So there are ways to diagnose it around the language barrier, but the treatment is the critical question. So who is going to be implementing the treatment in what language, and how is the child going to understand that?
So to address all of these things that we've talked about, it takes tremendous resources. Rose brought up, for instance, okay, what about rural areas? If you're going to get all of those tools, if you will, translators, telemedicine, diagnosis, and programs out to places that don't have access right now, how on earth do you do that?
Yeah, that's really important for us. We've just put into place a whole communications operation system, which we're trying to reach places more often. I also want to touch on, and Celine touched on this some, what we're seeing often is that children who are Black, for example, may get a different diagnosis, so they'll mm-hmm. still get access to some treatments, but for example, they might be called disruptive behavior disorder more often mm-hmm. as opposed to autism. So that's something that we need more education on as well.
So even in the diagnosis, we're seeing disparities.
Absolutely.
We've talked about a lot here, but one area that I think we can zoom in just for a little bit, and that is about what are we seeing in terms of treatment and cutting edge research. I've seen stories about how swimming has been beneficial. I've seen stories about how the use of technology with iPads. So where are we in terms of the treatment and, I guess, cutting edge or innovative, you know, treatments that we're seeing for kids with autism?
Right. Well, it depends on where we're starting in the lifespan. So we really focus on infants and toddlers when we can detect autism at its earliest stages. In that regard, we have to capitalize on the parents because they are primary in the child's care, so they should be the ones implementing the treatment, not a therapist per se. Whereas once we transition into a preschool or school environment, then it should be the education providers. And so we are making a lot of initiatives both in the Babies Can't Wait and early intervention communities, but also with an educational outreach program to do a train-the-trainer model in our school systems here in Georgia. Emily Rubin has already infiltrated mm-hmm. about 18 school districts with a train-the-trainer model. So we are really focusing on treating the child in their natural community, not having them have to come to a center like Marcus to get specialized treatment.
But also very important with that is that it's not just the, as Celine mentioned, the social communication. There are other many comorbid, as we call them, conditions. So we have one of the largest feeding disorders clinic because we see that quite often in autism, GI problems, 3 or 4 times more likely in children with autism than other children. We have sleep disorders. We have other pharmacological needs. So there are lots of cutting-edge treatments, and we cover all of those at Marcus.
Is there enough in terms of, and I don't want to say warning signs or symptoms, because sometimes parents just, you know, you've heard parents say, well, he's not developing or she's not developing like her older sister, so she's just slow in developing. But are there signs that parents should be looking for, and at what age?
Yes, absolutely. In the first year of life, we want to look for the social signs, like a lack of a social smile, a lack of joint attention, sharing your interest with something with another person through eye contact, gestures, pointing, clapping, waving, social interaction, reciprocity, and contingent interaction. These are the things that we will see impaired or delayed in infants at risk for autism compared to typically developing infants.
Ms. Gunter, perhaps to bring it back to where we started, you mentioned right at the beginning that we're still trying to determine whether there are genetic links that also tie into someone's background, someone's mm-hmm. genetic background. How close are we to perhaps discovering links to some types of conditions on the spectrum that might have a link to either race, ethnicity, whatever, cultural identification, whatever it might be, that might help us correct some of these disparities?
So we're at a really interesting time in genetics. The NIH is putting lots of money into the Precision Medicine Initiative, which is a huge, at least $130 million cohort that they're trying to do lots of genetic sequencing. That's kind of one of the in things now. There are a number of places who are doing big cohorts for autism genetic sequencing out there. So I would say we have some hints now as to specific conditions that only one genetic change can lead to autism. That's very rare. It's almost certainly going to be, for any one given child, a combination of a number of genetic factors plus some environmental factors that send someone on that trajectory. So, but I would say within the next 5 years, given all this genome sequencing we're doing, we will know a lot more.
We've been speaking with Celine Sonnier, Director of Clinical Research Operations, and Chris Gunter, who's the Associate Director of Research at the Marcus Autism Center. Thank you both for coming in and taking the time. We really appreciate it. And we want to hear from you. Do you have a story you'd like to share about this topic? Give us a call at 404-733-0934. That's 404-733-0934. And leave us your story. Ladies, thank you again for coming in. We really appreciate
it. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Keep us posted.